Ladies and gentlemen, my talk actually is was entitled Not Shakespeare and Keats, but Keats and Shakespeare. that is pedantic on my part. I failed to mention that, but it is the title of a book written by Middleton Mulley, which is not much known now, Keats and Shakespeare, and which is not, I wouldn't, this got some interesting things in it, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. But I do propose to speak mainly about Keats. And I just mentioned, and we're just about to the end of Keats' life. He was born at the end of October. We are nearing his birthday now. In fact, it seems uncertain whether it's the 29th or the 31st of October in 1795. And he died in February 1821 in his 26th year. But I'm going to speak about the years, simply the 2 years, 1818 and 1819, which were really the two last years of his life, because the whole of 1820, he was in his last illness. He knew that he was dying, and he didn't write anything in that year. He just lived for... He died at the beginning of 21. And in those last 2 years, it was extraordinary what he went through. But first of all, in 1818, he spent 3 months in the spring at his brother Tom's bedside. His brother was dying of consumption, and Keats himself had Keats himself had the premonition that he himself would probably die of the same thing. And he spent, again, the last 3 months of the year, that year, again at his brother's bedside, until he died. He had his 23rd birthday in that October while he was with his brother. The other brother, George, there were three brothers, used to say that nobody had understood John so well as Tom, the one who died. They were very close together. And then, early in the next year, it was that he met Fanny Brawne, fell deeply in love with her. And early that year, he wrote to the Eve of St. Agnes and said to have been written on the basis of that love, and he wrote also the Eve of St. Mark, and later in late spring the same year he wrote the Ode to the Nightingale, then later on the Ode to the Grecian Urn, to Melancholy. And he began also revising his poem, his epic, to be an epic poem, Hyperion, the first version of which he was not satisfied with. He began revising that. But in the autumn, he turned away from that. He broke away from that, and he wrote the Ode to Autumn. And then, 3 months later, he had this fatal hemorrhage, which he knew would be the end. He just lived for another year. But he described his life as a posthumous life during that year, that extra year. So you see, in just these 2 years, there was the death of his brother, his love unrequited enough, and these wonderful poems which he wrote. Then his final illness. Now, Tennyson, he didn't know, of course, that Tennyson was to say later that century, Keats would have become one of the very greatest of all poets had he lived. He also didn't know that many critics rank him on the odes alone as among English poets second only to Shakespeare. Many critics have said that. It's more or less the equivalent of that. Not to mention people like Thomas, like Bridges, and apart from Tennyson. And Keats' own consciousness of his gifts includes a sense of a mandate to enrich the world, and in his case, a sense of frustration through increasing premonition of his own imminent death. After he fell ill for his last illness, he wrote to Fanny, his beloved, saying, "If I should die," said I to myself, "I have left no immortal work behind me, nothing to make my friends proud of my memory. But I have loved the principle of beauty in all things. And if I had had time, I would have made myself remembered." He had already made himself more than merely remembered by writing the great odes, but his ambition was to write not them nor epic poetry, but to write great plays which, like Shakespeare's, revealed the harmony of the universe. In Keats's own words, the balance of good and evil. It is doubtful, to say the least, if Shakespeare would have accepted these words, the balance of good and evil. Still less would he have accepted another of Keats's formulations of the same, the love of good and ill, as being the summit of wisdom. But Keats's more mature formulation, beauty in all things, Shakespeare would no doubt have accepted, subject to correct interpretation, of course. Now, allow me to say, just by way of parenthesis, to touch briefly on the question of Keats' writing of plays. He was something of a man of the theatre. Of course, one cannot expect anybody to be such a born dramatist as Shakespeare. But Keats was a man of the theatre. He loved attending performances of Shakespeare and was altogether fascinated by the acting of Edmund Kean, about whom he writes a great deal, and to whom he attributed a real understanding of Shakespeare. What he says about Kean's performance of King Lear shows that it must have been, seeing what Keats writes, we would all be very anxious to attend such a performance if it were possible. But as to the plays which are published in the volumes of Keats's works, Otho the Great, it's not really Keats's play. I don't think he's ever, I've never heard of it being acted. I didn't find it very easy to read. I did go through it once, as far as I can remember, and it didn't leave any impression on me. And King Stephen, the other play, is just a fragment. But over 100 years after Keats's death, these lines were found written in the margin of another poem, unimportant and unfinished, called The Cap and Bells. They were just written in the margin. They hadn't been noticed before. And they appear to be, they appear to be a piece of dramatic verse, which Keats had the idea of writing. And they could be spoken as part of a love scene in a play, it seems to me, with great dramatic effect. And these are the lines. And probably they were written, addressed to his beloved family, but I'm sure never sent to her. And that would have been cruel. But they were just written in the margin, and he probably forgot about them. But these are the words, and they are, it seems to me, wonderfully suited to drama. This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold, and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights, that thou wouldst wish thy own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might stream again, and thou be conscience calm. See, here it is, I hold it towards you. Just those lines. Well, now that's the end of my parenthesis, and I must go on to say and point out that by nature, Keats was endowed not only with amazing poetic gifts, but also with a profound and penetrating intelligence, and with dazzling virtues. He was a personification of generosity. I would prefer to say magnanimity because it's more comprehensive, of resolution, sincerity, and resignation to the will of heaven. He's always quoting as though he is fascinated by the words which Edgar in King Lear speaks to his father, but his father wants to put an end to his life. Edgar says to him, "Men must endure their going hence, even as they're coming hither. Ripeness is all." And Keats, who loved especially King Lear, is always quoting those lines, always referring to them, which of course are the equivalent of Hamlet's words, "The readiness is all," to be ready for death is all. And when Keats fell in love with Fanny Brawne, being all of one piece himself, sincerity itself, he fell totally in love. And he expected her to do the same. He wrote to her, "Yourself, your soul, in pity give me all. Withhold no atom's atom, or I die." Well, she withheld more than an atom's atom. In fact, she withheld more than she gave, and he did die. But she was by no means the chief cause of his death, nor, being what she was, could she have given more. But his life might have been prolonged a bit longer if she had given more than she gave. But above all his gifts, or rather, let us say, by reason of this combination of excellences in the way of intelligence, will, and virtue, he was a born mystic, that is, in need of the inner or esoteric aspect of religion, the way of sanctification not merely the outer way of salvation, which was all that the religion of his upbringing offered to him. Now, Keats was brought up as a Protestant, and he was probably brought up to be prejudiced against Roman Catholicism, though he was much too intelligent to accept that, much too objective. But things were going wrong in religion already. The fact that at the beginning of this century, as I mentioned in my talk on Guénon, there was so much prejudice in France, which is not a Catholic country, there was so much prejudice, and there were wonderful popes on the throne at that time compared with what there is now, and there was so much prejudice against religion among the French so-called intelligentsia in the first two decades of this century that Guénon decided not to use the word religion in his books at all for fear that they wouldn't be read. He used the word tradition. He spoke of, and he based his writings, his message on the what he called the Hindu tradition. He didn't use the word religion. And so, well, that was in this century, but things were beginning to go wrong earlier on, and especially in Protestantism, much more vulnerable to decay than Roman Catholicism. And by being brought up as a Protestant, that meant that Keats had no knowledge of doctrine, practically no knowledge of Christian doctrine, no knowledge of Christian mysticism, practically no knowledge of the lives of the saints, or the meaning of sacraments, or even the full significance of rites. And being by nature a universalist, he was put off by Christianity's exclusivism, maintaining itself to be the only valid religion. And by these years, which we are now considering 1818 to 19, he had ceased to consider himself a Christian. But he accepted Christianity amongst other religions, and he was a believer, but he shrank from speaking about God as others do. For him, God was a great mystery, and Keats had come by that time to rely more on his own intelligence than on what the Christian religion gave him in the way of information. It was not difficult to think, as many did think at that time, that somehow religion had gone wrong. Keats's friend Lee Hunt, for example, was always scoffing at religion. Keats himself was groping in the dark intelligently, but not always infallibly. Now, as to Shakespeare, I have often mentioned that Dover Wilson as having said very rightly that Shakespeare lived in the world of Plato and St. Augustine. Although it was after the Reformation, the Middle Ages were still, he was still, as I have always maintained, one of the last outposts of the Middle Ages. And Shakespeare was also a born mystic. But in his case, his world, the world of Plato and St. Augustine, could give him the truths which he needed for his spiritual development. I repeat that Keats, again, was also a born mystic, unlike Milton, Wordsworth, Shelley, and Tennyson, and others. And hence, Keats's certitude that Shakespeare, because he saw that about Shakespeare, that Shakespeare was like a beloved elder brother to himself, a totally kindred spirit. He wrote in a letter, Keats wrote in a letter, "They are very shallow people who take everything literally. A man's life of any worth is a continual allegory, and very few eyes can see the mystery of his life, of his allegory." Shakespeare led a life of allegory. His works are the comments on it. The world that Keats was born into had little to give him except what was left of virgin nature. Above all, Shakespeare was his teacher. But he could not ask Shakespeare questions. And despite his great gifts, he was groping in the dark without help. Did he know that we are such stuff as dreams are made of? To quote Prospero's words in the text, "We are such stuff as dreams are made of." He might have answered, "The time will come for such truths, but now I am face to face with the world and must deal with that great problem first." This man of 24 had discovered, unaided, except as he would have insisted, by Shakespeare's help, that this lower world is penetrated by God. And with all his closeness and sincerity, he was concentrated on this wonderful truth and bent on conveying it to others. He sensed directly something of the harmony of this lower universe. But Keats did not yet know, as Shakespeare had well known, that this harmony is not independent of higher harmonies, nor can this harmony in itself be expressed as the balance of good and evil, as Keats had expressed it earlier, with reference to the plays of Shakespeare. The divine penetration of the world necessarily involves the transcending of evil by good. Even at the end of Othello, which does not enter into the greater mysteries, but it is, nobody could deny that this in this harmony, which undoubtedly one feels at the end of Othello, evil has been transcended by good. Keats needed to have certain things explained to him. He needed to know the difference between good and evil. I mean, their totally different substance and nature and origin. Because traditionally speaking, good comes ultimately from the absolute. Now these questions are universal truths to be found in all traditions, and the one reality is, by general agreement, the agreement is not always there, because for Christianity, Meister Eckhart had to insist on making a distinction between the personal God and absolute Godhead. He insisted on using the word Godhead, as Gottheit in German, to make a distinction between the divine essence, the absolute reality, and the personal God. He was made by the church to retract that, but that didn't. That was just a formality. For Platonists, the absolute is the sovereign good, to agathon. The absolute is pure positivity. It is the sovereign good. And St. Augustine and others beside him in all traditions have maintained that it is in the nature of the good to reveal itself, to radiate. The good must radiate. And radiation means eventually distance. And that is, one might say, distance from God. And distance is dangerous. And that is the origin of evil. Distance. So you see, the two things, good and evil, are of totally different natures. Good springs from the absolute directly. It is radiation, gradually becoming less and less by distance. But evil simply comes from distance. It is a purely negative thing. It is just distance. So the two things in themselves, good and evil, are of different substances, different natures, different origins. Keats needed to have that explained to him. He also needed to have it explained to him that paradise is in the nature of man, paradise where there is no evil and no suffering. It is in the nature of man. It has been, the paradise was lost at the fall of man. But nonetheless, man's primordial nature was not lost. It remained buried under a rubble, one might say, of accumulating second nature. But it is nonetheless there under that rubble, and paradise is still man's true homeland. And that is why children, who in some respects are wiser than their parents, just in some respects, but in this particular respect, children are unwilling to accept a story which does not end and they lived happily ever afterwards. That is wisdom on the part of children, not just wishful thinking. And the idea, the modernists would tell you that religion was invented by wishful thinking, it is the product of wishful thinking. But it is the opposite of the truth. Happiness, eternal happiness, is what we are made for, and what we should aspire to, and what people always have throughout history, and as far as one can make up prehistory, have been the world over aspiring to and preparing their way towards. But in the world as it was in Keats' day and as it is today, it is on the contrary, if you imagine that religion has gone wrong, as it certainly has to a certain extent, it's not difficult to slip into the error. And I've heard people say during my life, it seems to me quite often when I was young, through every stage of my life, I'm not prepared to believe in a God who does not suffer. I've often heard those words, and of course it is totally contrary to the teaching of all religion. The absolute is pure positivity. But especially in Christianity, with the Christian doctrine as it is, the two natures of Christ play a very essential part in Christian doctrine. Everybody is, every Christian is bound to recognize that Christ had two natures, and it is only the earthly nature that suffered. But nonetheless, that earthly nature is spoken of as God. The Virgin is often spoken of in Christianity as the Mother of God. So that the idea of a suffering God is something one can slip into fairly easily. And Keats had fallen into that very error. And in his poem, Hyperion, which is about the Titans being overcome by the Olympians, that is, by their children, being replaced by Saturn, Thea, and Hyperion, being replaced by Zeus, Hera, and Apollo. And the lines he wrote to the goddess Monita, which are in his second Hyperion, and which the writer of that book, Milton Murray, quotes as being, I think he himself had fallen into that error too, of the error of the idea of a suffering God. She is the goddess, and Keats puts the words of suffering into her mouth. It's a suffering which, as it were, a very compassionate suffering which embraces the whole human race, but which suffers more than any of them. Keats, I believe, this was at the end of 1819. When he was revising the poem, he suddenly broke away from it. He suddenly stopped writing it. And I think that he came to realize that this simply is an error. He broke away from it and he wrote one of his most serene and beautiful poems, The Ode to Autumn. It was in the autumn of 1819, and it was in the spring later that he entered into his last illness. And he had given himself to his own brother when he was dying, and one of his friends, Joseph Seven, gave himself to Keats after he fell ill, and he went with him, I think for 6 months he was with him, he went with him to Italy in 1820, and he died in 1821, in February 1821, and Joseph Seven was with him the whole time. I'll come back to this, but I would like to also mention Keats' ode to ode on a Grecian urn, which again has an extraordinary beauty and a serene beauty. I would just like to read you a passage from that, because it's also relevant to what we've been speaking of, that is the penetration of this world by God, this lower universe, and the harmony of the universe. I may say, I don't know what this urn is. It is what particular urn, I don't think anyone does know, but it's the ode on a Grecian urn. I won't read the whole poem, but I must say, I would rather have these lines than any Grecian urn I And this is a description of one of the stanzas. Who are these coming to the sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leadst thou that heifer lowing at the skies, and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town, by river or seashore, or mountain built with peaceful citadel, is emptied of its folk this pious morn? And little town, thy streets forevermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return. And this is the end of the poem. He dresses the urn. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man. To whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know. Now, by truth, she keeps clearly means God, and beauty, of course, is a manifestation of God. Now, this is the question this touches on the question of the penetration, the divine penetration, this mystery which Keats had discovered, that is, he had felt directly, and which he was bent on giving to mankind in plays, the divine penetration of this lower universe. It is, of course, a universal doctrine that the divine qualities do penetrate the world. That is the transcendent aspect even of this world, this lower world. And the best known example of this penetration is penetration by justice. The divine justice penetrates this world. From that, the Far Eastern religions have the well-known doctrine, which is called sometimes in English, the concordance, the doctrine of concordant action and reaction, which means that one can do nothing without there being a reaction to it. It may not come till after death, but one cannot escape from the divine justice which penetrates the whole of manifestation. And there is bound to be, for every action, a reaction. It's especially known, this doctrine, in Taoism and I think in Buddhism, but it's something which, of course, is really implicit in every religion. When speaking to his brother, who was his father, how that they had to undergo what they did through this very law of, doesn't use the words concordant action and reaction. But now, also, this is what Keats is telling us, that beauty penetrates this world in the same way. The substance of manifestation is penetrated by the divine beauty. And Frithjof Schwann, the late Frithjof Schwann, once wrote that by inverse analogy, whereas in man beauty is outward and goodness is inward, in God goodness is outward and beauty is inward. Beauty ranks among the very highest qualities of God, the very deepest and highest qualities of God. And that is why the arts, sacred arts, are always in the hands, in all traditional civilizations, are in the hands of the mystics. That is, the people who follow, who belong to the esoteric aspect of the religion. As Keats did it, not in fact, but in potentiality and by his nature. And he was conscious of this penetration of this world by beauty, and that is what he is trying to express in this poem. Now let me read you the part of his Ode to Autumn, which you know, I'm sure, but it would be relevant to express it here, which he wrote on breaking away from his other poem about the gods and goddesses, that is, the Titans who were overcome by the younger generation. I'll just read the first and the last stanzas of this poem, which you all know, I imagine. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has all brimmed their clammy cells. Then the last stanza. Where are thy songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy beauty too. When barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue, then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft the red-breast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies. Now, just a few words about the end. Keats, as I said, when he entered into his last illness, his friend Joseph Seven insisted on keeping him company till the very end. Now, Joseph Seven was himself a devout Christian, and Keats felt within himself the need for a religion, and that was the only religion within reach, really, and it had to be made use of. And Seven was just providentially the right person to be with Keats, and I'm sure I've read somewhere that in his last days Keats asked Seven to read him the Psalms, or some of the Psalms, and one is sure that among those which Seven read would be the Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He will lead me into green pastures where I shall neither hunger nor thirst." But, as I say, I can't remember where I read that, but what is certain is that Seven read to him during those weeks, those last weeks, extracts from Jeremy Taylor's book, Holy Dying and Holy Living. Now, I don't think I've ever read this book, and when I was decided to give this talk, I couldn't get hold of it. I don't possess it myself, and I would have looked at it in advance, but I was unable to do that, I confess. But Jeremy Taylor was born just within Shakespeare's life. And the book is very highly spoken of by many people, and he was a Protestant, but verging on Catholicism. It was what we call in English very high church. And he got into trouble under Cromwell for that. He was put in prison more than once. He was one time actually chaplain to Queen Henrietta Maria, and he took the king's side completely, in the, very definitely in the Civil War. And but what I've read about this book shows that it is just what Keats would have needed, being what he was. He was probably, in fact, more profoundly religious than Severn himself, but unable to practice the religion, which of course is something of essential importance. But it is, one likes to think that possibility was realized at the end for Keats. Who was really fundamentally profoundly religious in himself. Well, that I think is all I can say, all I had a chance to say. But if there are any questions anyone would like to ask, I will try to.